beautiful, but because of what it is in terms of the base content, and even though you're not seeing any sex, it's not something you can publish. Mm. But that doesn't mean that there's not space for butts and dicks. It's more just, I remember when I was editing X, and there was this beautiful man who I photographed in Paris, and you open the page, and on the right-hand page, there was a picture of him naked. But you never saw the left page because of it, because you were just
so focused on
the naked cock. So what I ended up doing was I moved that picture to the left. So you had a close tied up on his face.
Right, yeah.
And then your eye would move to the page, and then you'd move. So it's all about sort of understanding how you want someone to see your work and how the eye travels through an image.
Boys, Boys, Boys as a platform is about celebrating queer fine art photography, but how important do you think spaces like this are for ensuring that queer art remains visible?
Boys, Boys, Boys is an incredible thing, and I think Guillaume Pascal has done an incredible job. I don't know if anyone in the art industry really has the balls to do what he's done, which has actually been very successful, but I think for so long it's just sort of been tagged on to the rest of photography, but for queer photography to exist on its own has been quite an amazing thing. And I think it's also brought the community together in a space that's not a bar or a club or
focused around drugs and
yeah, it's a healthy experience, you know. And I think so many of the photographers that are part of this group are not from the UK, like they're from all over. They travel here, they come to the show. There are people who are taking photographs in places like Iran, which I find insane and scary. And I think this is why it's, you know, it's so important to make sure that you're seen, that it's normalized as much as possible within daily lives of everyone else, because otherwise you just get swept under a carpet like they used to, you know. Mm.
Right now we're seeing LGBTQ plus rights come under attack all around the world in some really obvious and outrageous ways, in a way that we would never have imagined 15 years ago that it would get like that. Does that impact the way that you think about your work and the way you go about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the moment I am wondering how to place the political sphere into my work a bit more. I was looking at, there's an artist, I think her name's Judith Posner. She's a really great lesbian photographer artist from, I think, the 70s, 80s. And she used to go around and spray paint on billboards, like slogans that they were against. And they're very sort of politicized. And she's got a great portrait of two girls kissing on the Westminster Bridge with, you know, Parliament in the background. And it's the 80s and it's punk and it's just pushing back. And I think it's very easy to vilify a minority or to take, you know, the poor trans population and unfortunately shit all over them on a continual basis, which at this stage is feeling infuriating. And the worry is that people like Keir Starmer, who doesn't seem to have, forgive me, enough backbone himself to do what's, you know, I don't think he pushes enough as a leader. I don't know. I feel like he'll jump on the bandwagon if it suits him more than anything. And because the bandwagon now is anti-trans, which, you know, we all know probably leads to anti-gay, I just don't know who's holding space for us in the political arena at the moment that has enough punch.
Do you think there's more pressure right now on queer artists to make work that's explicitly political? Or is just existing as a queer creator at the moment literally political in and of itself?
I think living and breathing and doing it alone is enough if that's what you want to do. I think some people are better suited to being political with their artwork. And I think if you can find a space to put politics in there, then go for it.
You do some other work to, I guess, support your ability to continue to with this photography career that's been brilliant. And making a living in fine art photography, what would you say has been the biggest challenge? Because it's not easy and it's not for everyone.
To be honest, you have to really want to do it. Because if you don't want to do it, it's too hard.
Yes.
And I find most of the time people who don't stick with it are people who have to just let it go because it's just too hard. And Like, there's nothing quite exciting as the night before a photo shoot and setting up studio space and looking through ideas and pulling the colors that I'm going to use, or, you know, all those sorts of bits and pieces that you do to prep. I love it. And, you know, I go to bed and I'm wide awake the next morning, ready to go. And I might have done a 5-day week elsewhere, but I'm ready to go. And
can you sleep the night before?
Yeah, of course. I'm tired. I'm too old not to sleep.
Young photographers trying to make a name for themselves at the moment, what would you advise them?
Write a list of your top 10 photographers that you're interested in and go get an assisting job.
Like with one of them?
With one of them. Like, cold drop their studios. Write them emails. When they say no, just keep on going back. Obviously, don't like hound someone to death, because then they'll just want to punch you. Do you know what I mean? I think as long as you're keeping in touch and regularly stopping by, or even just be like, hey, can I take you for a pint and ask you for some, just get into the arena, be around these people. And I think, you know, just keep on making work. The more you do, the better you get.
So I was watching an interview you did with, I think it's Milky. I watched it on YouTube earlier on. Where you walk through their gallery and we see your work with Amy Winehouse. And you said, and that's something that really stuck with me, you said that basically photographers nowadays are just buskers because of the advent of digital as opposed to film.
Yeah, it's a quote that it's from Tom Stoddart, an interview I did with him when I did a book called Photographers on the Art of Photography. And he's an incredible journalist, been around for a long time. And I guess what he was talking about was, We've moved on from the realm where photography was this hidden technical medium where you had to have certain gear, certain space. And we now have a situation where everyone has a camera, whether it's on their phone or a small digital camera. You know, it's accessible beyond. And I guess that hit home to me so well, coming from Dublin, where there's buskers just everywhere. You know, it's a busking city. Everyone has the capacity to take a good picture, but the people who actually are going to do it are the people who are going to stick with it and figure out how to make that good picture over and over and over again, no matter what the circumstances. We can all take a nice picture on our iPhone, but, you know, can you take a good picture when you're in the studio and you have a deadline and you have an entire crew stood behind you and
consistently
a client in the background tapping his foot and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But on a base level, photography is for everyone now.
Is that a good thing?
I think it's frustrating sometimes.
I'll bet.
But I mean, it's a beautiful thing, because as a medium in the art world, there's been a leveling of the playing field, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think whilst, you know, at times it's frustrating, it also is a beautiful thing.
You are listening to the Boys, Boys, Boys podcast, still to come on this episode. Stuart Lyndon Rhodes joins us live in the gallery with an audience for a Boys, Boys, Boys Meets event, where he shared stories behind his powerful new book, Lyndon Archives, a visual celebration of 1990s queer life in the north of England. And things get emotional with Charles Moriarty as we relive some of the early years with Amy Winehouse. In fact, Charles was the first photographer to get images of the iconic beehive. To come in next. Okay, I want to take you back to the Amy Winehouse. I've got the Amy Winehouse years written here, but it wasn't really, was it?
Well, we were good friends for a few years.
Were you?
Yeah.
How did you meet her?
I met her the day we did the album cover.
Okay, and then you may remain friends for a few years afterwards.
Well, she hated having her picture taken.
All the best people do, I think.
She was like, I remember it was her 21st birthday, I think it was, and I brought a print with me. She's like, that better not be a fucking print of me. I was like, it probably saved me, it's not. So the first time I met Amy was, she was 19, I was 21. We were at a flat in Spitalfields, and a mutual friend of ours, Tyler James, who was also a singer, introduced us. She'd had lots of pictures done with Ireland, and I hated them all. And I think,
why did she hate them?
I think they were sort of following a sort of cookie cutter look that was sort of around at the time. I think, well, she just wanted to be herself.
Yeah.
And she felt, if you listen to my lyrics and you look at that picture, they won't match.
And that's so much more important than I think people realize when it comes to taking musicians photos, isn't it?
The visual has to connect.
Yeah.
It's particularly back then when, you know, so much was MTV and, you know, I mean, I think your music videos needed to connect through to a degree, you know, but yeah, this was the first image a lot of people were ever going to see of her, which is the front cover. And
it was of the album Frank, wasn't it? The debut album.
It's a beautiful thing and a very...
Is it tinged with a bit of sadness?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's very... I try not to think too much about it because it's kind of like... It was just such an unnecessary thing.
Yeah.
So the first night I met her, we went out and we shot a roll of film. One of them ended up being the cover. And then the label were like, well, can you shoot the inlay? And I was like, sure. So Amy and I had a chat. We came back to the fact that we wanted to be authentic. So I was like, well, let's do it up in Camden at yours. We can shoot in the local pubs. We can make it as simple and easy as possible and as authentic to you. And that all sounded good to us. So we're just going to do what we did for the first role and just make more of it. And then, of course, our dates wouldn't line up. So we ended up in New York and Nick was like, just make it look like London. There were three shoots, but I've lost the legs for the third.
But you gutted about ours.
I'm sure they'll turn up out of
one day
at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
Or someone's got them somewhere.
Tell me about the shoot in New York, because it's quite funny, isn't it? Because nothing went according to plan, did it?
Well, Amy arrived. She'd been recording with Commissioner Gordon in New Jersey and was on her way to Salaam Remy in Miami. And so I had her for 24 hours, essentially. And it was July. I was having a summer holiday because I just finished university. And my cousin in New York had kindly given me his little flat, which happened to be at the Ritz Towers, which was quite nice. And so Amy drops her stuff off. We're like, let's go downtown. Let's find locations, all the rest. It's a beautiful sunny day. I, of course, hadn't looked at the weather and didn't know that there was they call it a nor'easter, which is like this enormous thunder and lightning storm, which arrived probably about 5 o'clock just before we were about to shoot. So I sort of sat there and I was like, I better turn on TV and find out what the weather is. And so all of our, because we were going to shoot at sort of golden hour in New York, and we didn't get out until midnight, I think.
Oh, so everything's completely different to what you planned.
Wet.
Is it all on the fly, everything?
All on the fly. So we just headed downtown. We did some stuff, but by then, you know, we'd been sat, we were both tired. We'd had some wine. We're, you know, and we did get some nice pictures. This is the one with the yellow phone, which I really love. And there's a few others that we shot that night, which are great. But I was like, look, we'd be better off going home and doing a few hours in the morning before you fly. So we did that, passed out. And the next day I was like, babe, we need to pull this shit together. And so up went the beehive, which was, I think, the first time she did it. And
that was the first time she did it?
At least for camera, yeah.
Again, that's a moment. I mean, it's the trademark beehive.
Yeah. Well, I think, and the thing is, what you realize now when I look at the pictures is like Amy knew how she wanted to be. She just hadn't gotten there.
No one had facilitated it. Yeah.
Yeah. So she does the look that she has by the time Back to Black comes out is a look that we were already doing in New York. But the label wanted her the way we'd shot her in New York for the album cover, or the way that they wanted the hair down. That's how they were selling her, do you know? But yeah, we shot another couple of rolls and put her in the car and then off she went. But they never got used. The ones from New York at all.
At all, right.
So I left them in the bottom of a drawer for about a decade. And it was only when Asif Kapadia was making his film that they came out of the drawer. And he was like, hey, I hear you have these pictures. So I went to speak to him in his office and share some of the stories. And then he was like, can you send them around? And then I didn't really think anything of it. I was working on a film at the time over in Pinewood. And I think it was a couple of weeks later, I went to bed and there was an email from him going, these are the best pictures I've ever seen. You better bloody well do something with them. And then I didn't think a huge amount of it, went back to work. And it was only when I saw the film